could be able to study with you this evening. I propose this evening for us to study together a lesson on faithful zeal. Zeal pleases God, but in order to be pleasing to God, it needs to be faithful. It should not be the zeal that Paul noted in Israel. In Romans, the 10th chapter, you'll notice there the first through the third verses. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved, for I bear them record that they have a zeal of God. And the implication is that that's good. That's commendable. God desires for us to have zeal. But he says, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves to the righteousness of God. And faithful zeal is not simply perplexed excitement, like Peter, let's say, on the day of Transfiguration, when it says in Mark, the 9th chapter, beginning at verse 5, and Peter answered and said to him, Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make 3 tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elias. For he knew not what to say, for they were all very afraid. Of course, fear excites us. Our knees may knock. And he was very excited. And we could equate excitement with zeal. But his zeal was not good, because all it actually was perplexed excitement. He didn't know what to say. And so he said something anyway. And the proposal that he made of making 3 tents, 3 temporary dwelling places, one for each of these figures, Jesus and Moses and Elias, looked like a good idea to him at that moment, because he hadn't thought about it. And zeal usually, in order to please God, faithful zeal has to have thought about things. And faithful zeal is not just big plans and no follow through. As Jesus warned against in his teaching in Luke, the 14th chapter, we notice there, beginning 25th verse, and there went multitudes with him, and he turned and said to them, if any man comes to me and hates not his father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sits not down first and counts the cost? Now, this is true of everything that we do, especially something that's going to be done in public, you know, where people will see it. We sit down and we make our big plans, but then if we have any wisdom at all, any thoughtfulness at all, we consider and project those plans. Where is this going to lead me? What am I going to have to do in order to bring this to its close? And so zeal needs to be more than just excitement that excites us to big plans with no follow-through. He said, for which of you, intending to build a tower, sits not down first and counts the cost? In other words, thinks whether he has sufficient to finish it. Lest perhaps after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. And what king going to war against another king sits not down first and consults whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him that comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is a great way off, he sends ambassadors and desires conditions of peace. Now, stop and think a minute where he started. When he started this morning, he said, if you're going to follow me, there are certain things that have to be in place. And your zeal in following me, and some of these people have been following you for a while at the time you turned to them and started making these statements. But he said, one thing that you've got to understand is that if you follow me, I have to be first. That whenever it becomes a matter, a question of whether or not this is going to do me good and is going to be supportive of me or is going to impact the relationship between you and me, or it's going to impact the relationship, say, between your father, your mother, your husband, your wife, your brother, your sister, I've got to be first. And he's not just kidding. This is absolutely the relationship. But he's saying this is the first thing you have to do. You have to be willing to take your cross, and this is a commitment. This is like a hangman's noose. You have to take your commitment to die for me, or you cannot be my disciple. He said he didn't say you can't be a first-class disciple. He said you just can't be my disciple. So the zeal that I have toward Christ has to be a thoughtful zeal. It can't just be something that says I will start this thing, but with no consideration where it's going to carry me in the future. In the Old Testament, in Numbers, the 25th chapter, beginning at verse 8:1 of Numbers 25, there's the story of Israel as they were sort of bogged down in sin. And they had gotten bogged down in sin, just like many people do today even, because they had been influenced by their ungodly neighbors. And they had accepted this. They were happy with this. There were reasons why they wanted to do this. And, of course, these were people that are going to wind up getting destroyed. There's a whole generation of Israelites that's going to stop living on earth before their children go in and inherit the promised land. But beginning reading there, it says, "And Israel abode at Shittim. And the people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people to the sacrifices of their gods. And the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined himself to Baal Peor. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, take the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. And Moses said to the judges of Israel, slay you every one his man that were joined to Baal Peor." Now, as we think about this, these people, you know, God says, this really is important to me. This is obnoxious. I hate this. I detest this. And apparently, from the context which we will read in a moment, a plague has started among the Israelites. It's wiping them out. And these people have been commanded to do something in order to stop God's wrath, to hang these leaders up, these people who have committed sin in this place, before the Lord. And Moses commanded them, said, to the judges of Israel, slay you every one his men that were joined to Baal Peor. Now, think about who they're talking about killing. They're talking about killing their neighbors, their kinfolks, their fellow Israelites, people that they have crossed the Red Sea with, some of them perhaps, people that they have suffered with, that they have mutually been upset with God with, that they have witnessed miracles with. And they are told to kill these people because they are committing sin against God. And if I read this context right, they weren't really moving to do this. Because, as it says in verse 6, "And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought to his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And I don't know whether they were weeping because God had placed such a hard thing upon them to do, whether they are weeping because they are facing something that they really do not want to do, that God's commanded. That has to be done in order to stop God's wrath, or Israel's just going to keep being hurt. But notice what it said. He brought this person. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand and went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. Now, it seems from the context that perhaps what we're looking at is God has made this commandment in order to stop what's happening. And the people are really upset by the impact. I mean, consider the emotional impact of this. That some family member has committed sin in this matter of Baal Peor, and you are called upon to kill this person. And so you are suffering greatly in front of the tabernacle. And then this man, right in front of everybody, brings a Midianitish woman. Obviously, he is intending to commit fornication with her in front of everybody, and Phinehas cannot stand it. He takes a javelin, and boom, he stops it. Here's what was said. And those that died in the plague were 24,000. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned away my wrath from the children of Israel. While he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consumed not the children of Israel in my jealousy. Wherefore, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace. And he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel. And I want us to notice a subtle thing here that we will notice in another illustration as well. He said that Phinehas was jealous for my sake. He said he was jealous for his God. Now, in each of the circumstances that we look at, zeal, being zeal that's acceptable to God and doing God's will, it is a zeal that is a zeal thinking of God. It's not thinking of me. You know, I'm going to have to do this seriously harsh thing, and I don't like this emotional. The emotional impact of having to do God's commandments is totally negative. That's not what Phinehas was thinking about. And so Phinehas acted in a totally different way, apparently, from all the other Israelites there. And notice, now the name of the Israelite that was slain, even that was slain with the Midianitish woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, a prince of the chief house of the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianitish woman that was slain was Cosbi, the daughter of Zur. He was head over a people and a chief in the house of Midian. And so we put this together and try to visualize what's going on here, and we see that some of these people were the heads of the people that were sinning. They were people that people had been taught from the time they were children to look up to. They were people that held big positions in the tribes of some of their neighbors, which they didn't see a big problem in associating with these people, even in their sins. And so we can understand the emotional impact of what God had required these Israelites to do in order to stop his wrath against them for the sins they were committing. But this man demonstrated a zeal for God that made him act totally different and think totally different from the others that were involved in this. Looking at David, the future king, we find a person who also demonstrated a faithful zeal for God. And he demonstrated at an early age. And we need to remember about David and the other people, Saul, the other people, especially about David, because he is on record about his attitudes toward God's word. When you read in Psalms, you read all of the things that David says about the word of God, about it being a light, about it being a guide, about it being something that a righteous person meditates upon day and night. Understand that David is talking about behavior of David. And you say, well, what of the scriptures did he have? Well, he had the Pentateuch, and he had the book of Joshua, and he had the things that we're reading in these history books up to this time, some of those, but he pored over those things. He filled his heart with those things. And I don't get the idea that he filled his heart with those things after he was an adult. I get the idea that as we meet David here early in his life, we meet a man who has a good relationship with God. And that's what we're talking about. I mean, this past meeting, it's all about God. It is all about God. Phinehas had a good relationship with God, a relationship with God that would not let him stand by and see somebody behave the way this Israelite was behaving. I don't care who he was, how high he was, how low he was. Phinehas had a relationship with God that would not allow him to allow what was going on to continue. And that's the subtle difference that we have between the characters that we have in these passages that we're looking at tonight, is the relationship with God and what these people were willing to do with that relationship with God. Some of them didn't have a relationship with God. Those fornicators didn't have a relationship with God, apparently. They didn't care about God. But we need to understand that God's word existed at this time, and people like David and Phinehas, they were aware of the will of God, of the person of God, of the attitude of God, of what it took to please God, and of the zeal that they ought to have toward God. So we look at 1 Samuel, the 17th chapter, and if we went back in the 13th chapter, we'd find that Saul had gotten in trouble, and he got in trouble there because he was afraid. He was afraid of the enemies of Israel. He was afraid of these uncircumcised Philistines that he was out fighting. He was just scared to death, and because he was afraid, he offered a sacrifice. He did something really stupid and really ungodly. And again, he's not thinking about God. He's not thinking about his relationship with God. He's thinking about himself and his fear. And he's not trusting in God. And so at that time, God had suggested that he was going to get somebody after his own heart. He's going to reject Saul. Saul was the first king, but he's already rejected pretty early in his kingship. And God is going looking for a man after his own heart. And I just suggest this because it turns out David is the man. But as we read this passage, it says, now the Philistines were gathered together, their armies to battle, and were gathered together at Shochoh. This in 1 Samuel 17, starting at verse 1. Which belongs to Judah, but that's where they were fighting. It belonged to Judah, but the Philistines were there, and pitched between Shochoh and Azekah at Ephraim, plenty of M's in that, Ephraim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched in the valley of Elah, and set to battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span, and he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass, and he had greaves of brass on his legs, and a target of brass between his shoulders, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. And he stood and cried to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am I not a Philistine, and you servants of Saul?" And that's that's a really legitimate question, because they're all out there in their soldier suits, and they're out there to get Philistines. And, of course, these Philistines should have been gone from that territory long before. And a question arises really quickly. This man comes out onto the battlefield, and why did not the soldiers of Israel cover him like hornets if you shook their nest? I mean, what did they do to let him come out into the field and challenge them? Notice what he says. "Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall you and your servant and be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now, here's the question, I think. And the question could have been asked when Adam preached on the temptation of Jesus. And, you know, Satan comes to Jesus and he sets up the proposition. He draws up the game plan. You know, if you are the Son of God, here's what you do. All right, this man says, "Why aren't you fighting?" Well, that was the thing. They should have been on him. Like I say, they should have been on him like hornets out of a chicken nest the minute he showed up. We find out in a verse or two that he was doing this for 40 days. The first day, they might have been surprised. The second day, he's done it before. The third day, the fourth day, somewhere along there, why isn't somebody up there in that field in the middle of the night, and when he comes out to make this claim, they just drop him? I don't read any place in the instructions that God gave Israel that he told them how to fight these uncircumcised sinners. He simply said, kick them out of the land, kill them, get rid of them, destroy them. But this man is setting up the equation, and they're going along with it. They're letting him do that. And so it tells us David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And the man went out among them as an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle. And the names of these 3 sons that went out to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the next Aminadab, and the third Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. In other words, if he had come out when the initial call was made, he did not stay there. He went back to do the chores. I mean, he was the youngest. He's the bottom man on the totem pole, and so he gets to do the chores. He gets to watch the sheep and not see the excitement. And the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. And Jesse said to David his son, "Take now for your brethren an ephah of this parched corn, and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of your brethren, and carry these 10 loaves to the captain of their 1,000, and look how your brethren fare, and take their pledge. Now, and take their pledge, and traded papers for myself. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting the Philistines. And David rose up early in the morning and went and left the sheep with the keeper and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going out to fight and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines and spoke according to the same words. And David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And again, you know, the man's obviously a tough thing. I mean, he's like a big tank out there in the field. But they didn't have to meet him man for man. All they had to do was bring him down. He was a Philistine. He needed to be stopped. And God hadn't given them rules. He just told them to go out and do it. They had thousands of men. Why did they let him do this? Well, one of the reasons was that they were afraid. They weren't personally committed. 10 of these Israelite soldiers were not willing to say, okay, we're 10 men, let's go get him. 20 of them. They weren't willing to commit themselves because they were not thinking of their relationship to God. And of course, David is here now. And they fled from him, and the men of Israel said, have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up? And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David spoke to the men, stood by, saying, what shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And, of course, the people answered him again. They didn't understand David, I don't think. But David's thinking ahead, I believe, far ahead. He's already developing a plan. It doesn't show up immediately, but as you consider this passage, it does show up. And his brother Eliab, in verse 28, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why came you down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the naughtiness of your heart, for you are come down that you might see the battle. Now, Eliab knew David. He'd known him since he was born. He had known him since he was younger than the smallest child we've got in the auditorium right now. And he had seen David develop. As I said a while ago, David later writes about his attachment to God's word. David is demonstrating in this circumstance about his attachment to God. The other people are not embarrassed to run from this Philistine. David was embarrassed to run from this Philistine. You notice he never did. He was thinking about his relationship to God. They were not thinking about their relationship to God. In the attitude of the Israelites that were stopped dead center because of one massive Philistine soldier, God wasn't the consideration. It was their safety It was their relationship with something other than God. But notice, David's question is to highlight something. These men were out here to fight Philistines. This man was a Philistine. He was not some sort of an apparition from God. He was simply a Philistine. He represented the enemy. They were out there to fight him. David's question is, why is this being made a big deal? Why are all these special considerations being given? Why is this being treated like some sort of a thing that is far beyond the call of normal duty? So that anybody that gives himself to this chore and actually succeeds is going to get all these blessings. His family's going to be blessed. And we can see how David's thinking. And David is not thinking like the others are thinking. And so his answer to his brother is, what have I done? What have I done? Is there not cause? And of course, we understand that there was absolutely cause. And so he says this to others, and he's agitating. And it gets back to Saul. It says, when the words in verse 31 were heard, which David spoke, they rehearsed them before Saul and sent for him. And Saul sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine. David had a plan. When he started agitating, he wasn't simply zeal that didn't think, where is this going to go? He knew exactly where it was going to go. As we develop this story a little bit further, we understand that David knew more than most people, most of us ever notice when we read this story. David knew exactly where he intended for this to go. So Saul said to David, hey, you're not able to do this. You can't fight against this Philistine, verse 33, because he's a big warrior. He has been since he was a child. He's been learning all these things, and you're just a kid, more or less, paraphrasing. But David was not thoughtless zeal. David was faithful zeal. David was not just jumping at something, just excited like Peter on the day of transfiguration, all excited and didn't know what to say and says something. He says, your servant kept his father's sheep. And there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. I don't know what experience you've had in seeing lions and bears in action, but when God designed those animals, he designed real, genuine predators. And a person could get hurt badly by one of those very quickly. You'd have to be good at martial arts before you could beat one. But David said, look, I'm not just jumping at something. I know what I'm talking about. And I went out after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them. David is thinking a certain way, and it's the right way. We need to listen to David. As one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God, you see that David's relationship to God in practically everything he says. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and the bear, out of the paw of the bear, he shall deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. Because Saul could see that he is dealing with this with logic. And it's good logic, sound logic. I mean, he knew what he could do because he'd done it. He knew what God could do because God had done it. And Saul armed David with his armor and put a helmet of brass upon his head, and he armed him with a coat of mail. David girded his sword upon him, and he attempted to go, for he had not proved it. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David took them off, and he took the staff in his hand, chose five smooth stones out of the brook, and put them in his shepherd's bag, which he had, even in the scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Now, stop and think about one little side issue. David had killed the lion and the bear, apparently with a staff and his sling, smooth stones. We think evidently that's what he used. Now, Saul is being helpful. He's going to give him something else. Here, you don't want to use those primitive tools. You want this better stuff. It's more up-to-date. If David had gone with the up-to-date, think about it. Would he be trusting in the power of God to deliver him? Or trusting in the power of the sword and the helmet and all of these things that he's wearing? Perhaps David thought about that. God delivered me with these tools that I use, that I know about. And so David took all that stuff off and went out to meet the Philistines, just like went out to meet the bear and the lion. Trusting in the same God, the same skills that he had developed, probably the other hand, but anyway. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him. And he was, for he was but a youth and ruddy and fair of countenance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you have come to me with staves?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods, which of course were false gods. He was an idolater. All of the Philistines were. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." Then said David to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear, with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel. You have defied this day." Now notice what David says here. I think that's very important. I think it gives us a different perspective on David than perhaps we have ever had. You sort of get this perspective when he is being run out of Jerusalem by Absalom, who has just suddenly revolted against him, and he's about to get killed, David is. And he vacates Jerusalem, but before he leaves, he puts in place some things that are going to let him fight a better battle tomorrow and the next day and ultimately win. I think a little of that is showing up here. Notice what he says. "This day will the Lord deliver me into you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day to the fowls of the air, to the wild beast of the earth, and all the earth will know that there is a God in Israel." And all this assembly, part of that assembly were Philistines in front of him, part of it's Israelites behind him. But he said, all of this assembly, everybody shall know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give it into our hands. The Israelites need to learn that. Now, listen to his speech. He does not have a sword in his hand, but he already has in mind exactly what he's going to do. He's going to go out on the field. He's going to strike that Philistine. That Philistine's going to fall. He is going to leap on him and take the Philistine's sword and cut off his head. And when those Philistines see that this head is not attached to this giant any longer, they are going to be shocked. I mean, they built up quite a bit of confidence, no doubt, in 40 days of this great big giant going out and challenging all these soldiers of Israel, and they won't move a muscle, and so they are very confident. And all of a sudden, in the time it took David to strike that man, run to him, take off his head, and let them see that it was off, all of their hopes are dashed. And he knows what they're going to do. They're going to turn and run. And one thing about it, in hand-to-hand combat, you can run toward an enemy and fight pretty well, because you can throw your spears, you can sling your stones, you can wave your sword, you can shoot your arrows. But when you turn your back on the enemy, you are his meat, because you can't do any of that. So David knows this. I mean, David is thinking. He is zealous, but he is faithfully zealous. He is thoughtfully zealous. He has counted the cost. He knows exactly where it's going. He knows that those Philistines are going to be food for wild beasts and birds of carrion. And he knows this before he ever comes in contact with that Philistine. So, it came to pass when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran to the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, and the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with slinging a stone, and stood and struck the Philistine and killed him. And there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine, and took his sword and drew it from the sheath thereof, and killed him, and cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until you come to the valley and the gates of Ekron, and the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Sharon, even to Gath and to Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. David knew exactly what he was doing, and he had zealous faith. And the base, or faithful zeal, and the basis of that zeal and of that faith was his realization that it's all about God, just like we study. I mean, really, it really is. That everything we do in our life has to do with our attitude toward our relationship to God. Think of Joseph, you know, as a slave. Potiphar's wife challenges his spiritual fidelity. And he said, I can't do this. How can I so sin against God? He knew that his relationship was not between the people up and down the pew. His relationship was with God. And that's what each of us must understand in order to have zeal that is faithful and that will please God and that will serve us throughout our life in pleasing God. Now, faithful zeal meets life's challenges with service to God. There may be those tonight that are not members of the body of Christ that you've heard Mark 16 and Matthew 28 talked about, and the things that Jesus said that we need to become repentant, baptized believers. We need to be immersed for remission of our sins. We need to rise and walk in new life. You may not have done that, but there is no other way for you to build the relationship between you and God upon which faithful zeal can be built except by obeying the words of God. And so whatever your need at this time, we urge you to come and let us know. Let us help you in pleasing God while we stand and sing.